Time magazine describes the fiction of Keller Link as a place few writers go, a netherworld between literature and fantasy, Alice Munro and J.K. Rowling. Keller Link's new short story collection is called Pretty Monsters. Although it's her third collection, it's the first to be aimed at young adults. Adults of any age are sure to enjoy Link's fiction. Keller Link talked with Anne Strainchamps about the difference between writing for young adults and not-so-young adults.
I suppose there's a difference. A lot of the stories I originally wrote for young adult anthologies, anthologies of ghost stories or anthologies of modern fairy tales that were specifically for children. There's actually some overlap between the first two collections and Pretty Monsters. There are three stories, all of which originally I had in my head as I was writing them, that they were stories that I would have enjoyed when I was, say, 14 or 15.
Of course, a lot of the characters in the stories are teenagers themselves.
Yes.
Is that an age you especially like writing about?
You know, I've heard people say that every writer has an age, a specific time period that they're drawn to write about. And this may be a historical moment in time that you find yourself coming back to over and over again. I'm drawn to stories in which a character is experiencing something for the first time, in which they're entering into a new world. It might be a fantastic landscape, or it might be a new kind of situation that they haven't encountered before. And there's a mesh between that kind of storytelling and the kinds of stories that young adults like, obviously.
Hmm. Well, a great many of your characters encounter situations that are definitely out of the normal. We should start by talking maybe about the first story in this collection called The Wrong Grave. Will you tell us about that one?
Sure. This is a story that I wanted to write for a long time. There's a story, a true story, about the poet Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who buried his poetry with his long-term partner. In fact, I think they were married, and these were the only copies of the poems that he had. And at a certain point, he dug her back up in order to retrieve the poetry, which is a story that's always really stuck with me. And I also wanted to write a story that was a fairy tale in a way, about a guy who does something and encounters a supernatural being and has to get out of that sticky situation that he's gotten himself into. And so in my story, it's a teenage boy who wants to be a poet, who has done the same thing that Dante Gabriel Rossetti has done. He's buried his poetry with his dead girlfriend. And so he goes and he digs it up. And gets into trouble.
It's got a great beginning. Could you read just the first paragraph of it?
Sure. All of this happened because a boy I once knew named Miles Sperry decided to go into the resurrectionist business and dig up the grave of his girlfriend, Bethany Baldwin, who had been dead for not quite a year. Miles planned to do this in order to recover the sheaf of poems he had and what he'd felt was a beautiful and romantic gesture put into her casket. Or possibly it had just been a really dumb thing to do. He hadn't made copies. Miles had always been impulsive. I think you should know that right up front. He tucked the poems, handwritten, tear-stained and with crossouts, under Bethany's hands. Her fingers had felt like candles, fat and waxy and pleasantly cool until you remembered that they were fingers. And he couldn't help noticing that there was something wrong about her breasts. They seemed larger. If Bethany had known that she was going to die, would she have gone all the way with him? One of his poems was about that, about how now they never would, how it was too late now. Carpe diem before you run out of diem.
You know, this is both an outlandish premise, and yet somehow it seems perfectly in keeping with a teenager. You know, it's that self-absorption.
Well, these are fun characters to inhabit when you write a story because they're... The responses are sometimes very large. You know, teenagers are given to dramatic gestures, and yet you sort of sympathize with them because even as an adult, you remember being a teenager and you remember having these outsized emotions.
Yeah, and poor Miles thinks he's going to be a great poet and, you know, he needs to rescue his poems for posterity. So things go rather spectacularly bad for him once he digs up his girlfriend's grave because, well, for one thing, it turns out he's dug up what seems to be the wrong girl. I wondered if you could read a bit of the section where he discovers his mistake.
Sure. I'm reading the section in which the adolescent poet Miles has successfully, with the aid of a special shovel, dug up the coffin of the girl that he thinks is his girlfriend. And in fact, it turns out that he's not only dug up the wrong grave, but when he gets the lid open, it turns out that the wrong dead girl in there is a little bit more lively than you might expect. The wrong dead girl spoke first. "Knock, knock," she said. "What?" Miles said. "Knock, knock," the wrong dead girl said again. "Who's there?" Miles said. "Gloria," the wrong dead girl said. "Gloria Palnick, who are you, and what are you doing in my grave?" "This isn't your grave," Miles said, aware that he was arguing with a dead girl, and the wrong dead girl at that. "This is Bethany's grave. What are you doing in Bethany's grave?" "Oh, no," Gloria Palnick said. "This is my grave, and I get to ask the questions." A notion crept like little dead cat feet over Miles. Possibly he had made a dangerous and deeply embarrassing mistake. "Poetry," he managed to say. "There was some poetry that I accidentally left in my girlfriend's casket, and there's a deadline for a poetry contest coming up, and so I really, really needed to get it back." The dead girl stared at him. There was something about her hair that Miles didn't like. "Excuse me, but are you for real?" she said. "This sounds like one of those lame excuses. The dog ate my homework. I accidentally buried my poetry with my dead girlfriend." "Look," Miles said, "I checked the tombstone and everything. This is supposed to be Bethany's grave, Bethany Baldwin. I'm really sorry I bothered you and everything, but this really isn't my fault." The dead girl just stared at him thoughtfully. He wished that she would blink. She wasn't smiling anymore. Her hair, lank and black, where Bethany's had been brownish and frizzy in summer, was writhing a little, like snakes. Miles thought of centipedes, inky midnight tentacles. "Maybe I should just go away," Miles said, "leave you to rest in peace or whatever." "I don't think sorry cuts the mustard here," Gloria Palnick said. She barely moved her mouth when she spoke, Miles noticed, and yet her enunciation was fine. "Besides, I'm sick of this place. It's boring. Maybe I'll just come along with."
I can't tell who I like better, Miles or the dead girl.
I'm very fond of both of them. Miles does some very impulsive, sort of thoughtless things. But I am certainly sympathetic to anybody who values poetry so highly, even if it's his own poetry.
Poor Miles. The dead girl turns out to be remarkably difficult to get rid of, too.
Well, this is what happens when you get into a sticky situation with somebody. It's hard to disentangle yourself, especially if they have a lot of hair.
So another archetype of horror fiction, besides the graveyard setting we were talking about, is the scary campfire story. And that's a convention you play with in a story you wrote called Monster. Could you describe that one?
Monster is about a kid who is at a boys' summer camp and is not having a particularly good time. And they've gone hiking, and they're going to spend the night on a hill, Lookout Hill. And there have been reports from other campers of a monster on this hill. And in fact, they do encounter the monster, which only sort of adds to the fact that the whole camping experience has not been a good one.
Well, in this particular story, you know, it's a horror story, so of course the monster that the kids in the other cabin have been scaring your kids with turns out to be real. Only since it's a Kelly Link story, it's not actually your everyday sort of monster. Could you read a bit about, you know, what happens when the monster shows up?
Sure. The monster had one Simpson twin under each arm. The twins were screaming. The monster threw them down the path. Then it bent over Brian Jones, who was lying half inside one of the tents, half in the snow. There were slurping noises. After a minute, it stood up again. It looked back and saw James Lorbeck. It waved. James Lorbeck shut his eyes. When he opened them again, the monster was standing over him. It had red eyes. It smelled like rotting fish and kerosene. It wasn't actually all that tall, the way you'd expect a monster to be tall. Except for that, it was even worse than Bungalow 4 had said. The monster stood and looked down and grinned. "You," it said. It had a voice like a dead tree full of bees, sweet and dripping and buzzing. It poked James on the shoulder with a long black nail. "What are you?" "I'm James Lorbeck," James said. "From Chicago?" The monster laughed. Its teeth were pointed and terrible. There was a smear of red on the dress where it had touched James. "You're the craziest thing I've ever seen. Look at that dress. Look at your hair. It's standing straight up. Is that mud? Why are you covered in mud?" "I was going to be a monster," James said. He swallowed. "No offense." None taken, the monster said. Well, maybe I should go visit Chicago. I've never seen anything as funny as you. I could look at you for hours and hours, whenever I needed a laugh. You've really made my day, James Lorbeck. The snow was still falling. James shivered and shivered. His teeth were clicking together so loudly he thought they might break. What are you doing here? He said. Where's Terrence? Did you do something to him? Was he the guy who was down at the bottom of the hill, talking on a cell phone? Yeah, James said. Is he okay? He was talking to some girl named Darlene, the monster said. I tried to talk to her, but she started screaming and it hurt my ears, so I hung up. Do you happen to know where she lives? Somewhere in Ohio, James said. Thanks, the monster said. He took out a little black notebook and wrote something down. What are you? James said. Who are you? I'm Angelina Jolie, the monster said. It blinked. James' heart almost stopped beating. Really? He said. No, the monster said. Just kidding.
I'm curious, the scary story, whether it's a ghost story or a, you know, classic horror story, it's been around for such a long time. What do you think is the perennial appeal? Why is it that we like to scare each other in stories?
I think being afraid in some ways is the same thing as falling in love. It's of a shorter duration, but there's the same charge as going out with somebody and realizing that you really, really like them. Reading a story and getting that frisson of terror is somehow very pleasurable, and it tends to be very individual, that things that might scare another reader are not necessarily going to scare me when I'm reading. In fact, you know, I'm not a big fan of movies like Saw. I would much rather watch a movie in which you never see the bad thing that happens. You, in fact, you're sort of straining to see it at the same time that you're hoping that you don't see it. I think that there's something that's hardwired in us that we get a certain kind of pleasure out of being a little bit afraid. And I don't think it's so much that, you know, when things are bad, that it's a relief to read a ghost story and have that same thing internalized. Because frankly, I like ghost stories when things are really good, when the economy is good, when there's somebody in the White House that I like. I still want to read a ghost story in the same way that I do when the economy is in the toilet. I have been told, though, by editors who have worked in publishing and by writers who write horror novels that in terms of popularity, that you can sort of trace publishing and see that when there's a Republican in the White House, that horror novels do really well. And when there's a Democrat in the White House, that mystery novels end up being the genre that sells the best.
And do you think there's a reason?
I don't know. I'm hoping to be able to chart this. I feel like horror has been on the rise for the last couple of years in publishing. You know, frankly, I wouldn't mind a couple of years in which people are really looking for mystery novels.
Kelly Link's new short story collection is called Pretty Monsters. She spoke with Anne Strange-Shams.